content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mary Grace Payton for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religion News Service and the New York Times News Service. Our first article was published by RNS on November 6, written by Aleha Hertzler McCain, and entitled, Faith Groups Resolve to Protect Migrants, Refugees, After Trump Win. Former President Donald Trump's election to a second term prompted faith groups that work with migrants and refugees to reaffirm their commitment to continue their work. On Wednesday, November 6, after Trump campaigned on blocking migration and carrying out record deportations. Given President-elect Trump's record on immigration and promises to suspend refugee resettlement, restrict asylum protections, and carry out mass deportations, we know there are serious challenges ahead for the communities we serve, said Krisha Mehra Vinara, President and CEO of Global Refuge, formerly known as Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service, in a statement. On the campaign trail, Trump also promised to end automatic citizenship for immigrants' children born in the U.S., end protected legal status for certain groups, including Haitians and Venezuelans, and reinstate a travel ban for people from certain Muslim-majority areas. If Trump carries out his plans, FWD.US, an immigration and criminal justice reform advocacy organization, projects that by the start of 2025, about 1 in 12 U.S. residents and nearly 1 in 3 Latino residents could be impacted by the mass deportations, either because of their legal status or that of someone in the household. If the mass deportation articulated throughout the campaign season is implemented, it would tear families, communities, and the American economy apart. Mark Hetfield, president of HIAS, a Jewish nonprofit working with refugees, said in a statement. The solution to the disorder at the border is to prioritize comprehensive immigration reform that updates our antiquated immigration laws while protecting people who need refuge. We will continue to speak truth to power in solidarity with refugees and displaced people seeking safety around the world, Hetfield said. We will not be intimidated into silence or inaction, his organization wrote. Omar Angel Perez, Immigrant Justice Director for Faith in Action, a social justice organization, said in a statement, We recognize the fear and uncertainty many are feeling and pray that we can channel that energy into solidarity and resilience. This moment calls us to take immediate action to protect the communities targeted throughout this campaign and during the prior Trump administration, Perez said. We remain committed to providing resources, support, and training to empower people to know their rights and stand firm against attempts to undermine their power. Matthew Sorens, Vice President of Advocacy and Policy at World Relief, the humanitarian arm of the National Association of Evangelicals, pointed to polling by Lifeway Research earlier this year that showed that 71% of evangelicals agree that the U.S. has a moral responsibility to accept refugees. A majority of Christian voters supported President-elect Trump, according to the exit polls, but it would be an error to presume that means that most Christians align with everything that he said in the campaign related to refugees and immigration, he said. Sorens explained that when Christians realize that most refugees resettled to the U.S. in recent years have been fellow Christians, that they've admitted lawfully after a thorough vetting process overseas, and that many were persecuted, particularly because of their faith in Jesus. My experience has been that they want to sustain refugee resettlement. We're doing all we can to encourage President-elect Trump, who has positioned himself as a defender of Christians against persecution, to ensure that the U.S. remains a refuge for those fleeing persecution on account of their faith, or for other reasons recognized by U.S. law, he said. In a statement, Jesuit Refugee Service said Trump's 2024 campaign rhetoric and his previous term had harmed forcibly displaced people. Policies in his first term separated families, set up new hurdles in the asylum process, dramatically reduced the number of refugees the U.S. resettled, introduced a ban on admitting travelers from predominantly Muslim countries, and deprioritized international efforts to address the exploding global refugee population, the Catholic organization said. To welcome and serve migrants is an obligation for Catholics, the JRS statement said. How we respond to tens of millions of people forced to flee their homes is a serious moral, legal, diplomatic, and economic question that impacts all of us, the organization wrote. Despite the disproportionate impact that Trump's proposed immigration policies would have on Latino communities, Trump made significant gains among Latinos compared with previous elections, winning Latino American men's votes by 10 points. The Reverend Samuel Rodriguez, a president of the National Hispanic Christian Leadership Conference, attributed Trump's success to several factors, including rejection of progressive ideologies, economic concerns, and concerns about government overreach. But the evangelical megachurch pastor also said, while immigration is a nuanced issue within the Latino community, there is a growing sentiment against open border policies and the provision of resources to illegal immigrants at the perceived expense of American citizens. Karen Gonzalez, a Guatemalan immigrant and author of several books on Christian responses to immigration, called Trump's victory in the popular vote especially crushing in light of his anti-immigrant rhetoric. She attributed Trump's success with Latinos to white supremacy and misogyny within the community. We really aspire to be secondary white people, and we think that aligning ourselves with white supremacy is going to save us, and it's not, she said. Gonzalez was among the faith leaders who said they had not emotionally reckoned with the possibility of a Trump win before the results were announced. Dylan Corbett, executive director of Hope Border Institute, a Catholic organization that supports migrants in El Paso, Texas, and in Ciudad Juarez, Mexico, across the U.S.-Mexican border, told RNS, I was hopeful that we had turned the page because I think the first Trump term represents a really challenging time in our country. Corbett called for deep reckoning in churches and grassroots communities. There's the perception that the immigration system is broken, and I think the longer we wait to really fix the situation, you open up the door to political extremism. You open up the door to incendiary rhetoric, to cheap solutions, he said. While President Joe Biden's administration had begun with some really aspirational rhetoric, it left a mixed legacy on immigration, opening the door to Trump's dangerous politics. Faith leaders in particular are going to have to assume a very public voice in defense of the human rights of now a very vulnerable part of our community, he said. Corbett expressed concern that Trump might mirror Texas Governor Greg Abbott's tactics in Operation Lone Star in his push for massive deportations, citing deaths due to high-speed chases on highways and record migrant deaths. It's going to fall to border communities like El Paso to deal with the fallout of what we can expect will be the very same broken policies and some very dangerous rhetoric, Corbett said. And so I think we have to prepare for that. And that means turning back to the faith, going back to the Gospels, going back to the witness of Jesus, the witness of the saints, martyrs, he said. In Global Refuges' statement, the organization encouraged Americans to support immigrants and refugees, emphasizing the importance of family unity, humanitarian leadership, and the long-standing benefits of immigrant and refugee contributions to U.S. communities and economies. Vinara added, "In uncertain times, it is vital to remember that our role as Americans is to help those in need, and in doing so, we advance our own interests as well." Perez told RNS before the election that Faith in Action had prepared for a potential Trump win and that the organization would draw on its experience responding to the attacks on the immigrant community and mounting protection defense campaigns to prevent deportation. Gonzalez recalled working in a legal clinic after Trump's 2016 election and helping migrants process citizenship and sponsorship applications before he took office. This is really the time for that sort of practical action of how we can serve our neighbors, she said. Together, we will transform our grief into a force for change that will build a more just, equitable society that respects the dignity of all people, Perez said. Now an article from the New York Times News Service, written by Isabella Kwai and entitled Notre Dame's Bells Ring Together for the First Time Since Fire. And this was published on November 11. The bronze bells of the Notre Dame Cathedral have not pealed together since 2019, when a furious blaze consumed the centuries-old landmark right before the eyes of horrified Parisians. For Paris on Friday, they tolled once again. The sound of the eight bells rang throughout the city for the first time in 5 years, a sign of the cathedral's rebirth as it prepares to reopen to the public next month. A weekend of ceremonies starting December 7 will celebrate the opening after an ambitious and expensive effort to rebuild the 860-year-old structure. "It's not perfect yet, but we will make it perfect," Alexandra Guguillon, who was in charge of the reinstallation of the bells, told Agence France-Presse. This first test was a success. The eight bells in the northern belfry, a key part of the cathedral's collection of 21 bronze bells, had been cleaned before being replaced in the tower. Videos taken by AFP inside the cathedral show the bells swinging in the cathedral's newly rebuilt northern belfry. A symbol of France's modern history will join them. Three new bells, including one that was rung during the Paris Olympic Games, have also been installed. Investigators have still not determined the cause of the fire that ravaged the cathedral in April 2019, though leading theories include an electrical short circuit and a discarded cigarette. Thousands of Parisians watched aghast from the banks of the Seine as firefighters battled to contain the flames, which destroyed much of the cathedral's roof and toppled its spire, but ultimately spared the cathedral's main structure. In the aftermath, President Emmanuel Macron had vowed that the cathedral would be rebuilt within 5 years, and more than 850 million euros in donations poured in within days. Hundreds of people, architects, engineers, masons, metal workers, carpenters, and more, have labored at the construction site to meet the 5-year target. The work has included rebuilding the collapsed spire, making a new wooden attic, and cleaning more than 450,000 square feet of stone surfaces that had been darkened by soot, dust, and lead particles. The cathedral, an example of medieval Gothic architecture, had become synonymous with the history of France itself. It was where Henry VI of England in 1433 was made King of France, where Napoleon Bonaparte in 1804 was crowned emperor, and where Charles de Gaulle led a Thanksgiving ceremony in 1944 after the liberation of Paris during World War II. The dulcet peals of Notre Dame's bells accompanied some of that history, marking daily time for generations of Parisians. Many of the bells, given their own names, have been recast and remade over the years. The largest of the bells, located in the South Tower, dates to the 17th century and has been rung at some of the most important events in French history, including both world wars. Now an article from the Religion News Service written by Yonat Shimran and published on November 7. Norman Wurzba on Finding Hope in the Midst of Crisis. Norman Wurzba was not expecting that his book of essays about hope would land the week before Donald Trump scored a decisive victory over Vice President Kamala Harris. But the Duke theologian, who writes about the environment, is no stranger to contemplating upheavals, whether a climate disaster, war, genocide, or the excesses of financial capitalism. His new book, Love's Braided Dance, Hope in a Time of Crisis, offers meditations on all these cataclysms and how individuals found ways through them. Again and again, he returns to the theme of finding hope in the yearning for a more loving world, one that propels people to give to others and to sustain the Earth's creative life. Those hopes are not sentimental or naive. He writes about people who've gone through immense pain and suffering, but have found a way to stay engaged and involved with others. Life's mysteries and splendors, what we might call its ever-fresh potential, are discovered as people work to be genuinely with each other, and in this work, nurture and strengthen the bonds that join them, Wurzba writes. RNS spoke to Wurzba on the day after the presidential election. Why did you want to write a book on hope? Hope is one of those really big words that I think is really important in a culture. But it had become a word that is held with a lot of suspicion. And I wanted to try to understand why. In talking with younger people, my adult children, many of their colleagues, and then also students here at the university, I found they were suspicious of the term, especially when it's uttered by people like me, an older white man. A line I heard more than once was that young people are saying they're not going to have children because they can't imagine bringing children into a world like the one we are in, and apparently the one we are heading into. I thought, this is something that needs to be thought more about, because I believe hope is a valuable characteristic in a well-functioning life. I want to find a way to take their concerns seriously, but also provide them an avenue for thinking about their own futures that will sort of draw on what the best is about a term like hope. I don't want the term hope to just disappear. It's a way of being that needs saving and cultivating, actually. That leads right into our present moment. Many progressives are feeling hopeless watching the presidential returns. What would you say to them? It's important to acknowledge the fear and the anger and the frustration. Those are actually important because they communicate the loss, the sense of loss, the sense of protest, and the sense there is still something you love, something you care about. And when you sense that it's being taken away from you, that confirms for you that this world is still beautiful and that communities and other people are still beautiful. We need to figure out how we're going to learn to cherish them and nurture them in a context which, obviously, from a political economic standpoint, has become much more difficult. We should not deny the frustration and the anxiety, but say, let's tap into that love and build communities of people who can help us focus that love, activate that love, because the world still needs protecting and nurturing. All of us still have people we care deeply about, neighborhoods we care deeply about, natural places we still want to see flourish. And the only way you can move forward is to keep the focus on what you love and not let the fear or the anxiety or the frustration sink deep into your bones, because when that happens, we become sick as people. And when we're sick, we can't do the work we need to do. Climate change is a big theme throughout the book, and under a Trump administration will likely be less of a policy priority. Yes, for sure. I think what this tells us is that we're going to have to become much more active as citizens, and we're going to need to work and build coalitions with other people and communicate as clearly as possible to business leaders and political leaders about the importance of these things. The worst thing would be to simply give over the whole of political and policy life to these very wealthy people who now really care primarily about their own wealth accumulation rather than the good of society. Educational institutions play a major role here. We need to be places that talk about shared values, shared concerns. Faith communities of all kinds are going to need to play a major role going forward. Is there anything people on their own can do? I think the crucial thing is to not allow ourselves to slip into a pit of isolation. That's my temptation. I want to be quiet and sit by myself and think about all the horrible things that are likely to happen. That's the worst thing to do. It's so important to connect with other people as individuals to be assured that the things you love are also things that other people love and care about, so we don't lose sight of the love. We really need to be encouraging to each other, so that we don't let that frustration and anger and fear become the main thing that drives us. And so, if you've got any sort of bandwidth, now is the time to reach out to your friends, to your family members, to neighbors, and start the conversation. Figure out how you're going to activate that love. The social media platforms right now are the instruments of rage and frustration. You've got to learn to minimize some of that now. You've got to make contact with real people and spend time outside to see and smell and taste the beauty of this world. So we're constantly reminding ourselves and each other about how beautiful this world and this life still are. Do you think society is ready to critique capitalism and corporate oligarchy? I think what's becoming clear as people look around is that the wealth inequality is just getting worse, and there are precious few signs that we have the leadership, whether in business or in politics, that's really concerned enough about it. I think what's become clear also is that this obsession with the continually growing economy is doing so much damage to our places and communities. And I don't know what's going to need to happen for people to say we simply have to stop the growth imperative and start thinking not in terms of quantity, but about the qualities of our relationships. There's no question the capitalist machine of ever greater expansion, ever more optimization, ever more accumulation are not making people happier or the world safer or cleaner or more fertile. I wish I knew what is going to be that sort of pivot point that is going to finally convince enough people to say that the whole model by which we've been operating is a nightmare for future people. I think what we're going to need to do as communities is to figure out demonstration projections in which we see how it's possible to organize our economic life in ways that promote good quality of life, that promote mutual care and flourishing, that make our homes more beautiful and more safe, our neighborhoods cleaner, our educational institutions more focused on the well-being of students. Your book is reminiscent of Robin Kimmerer's book, Braiding Sweetgrass. She talks about how people need to feel that the earth loves them back. What kind of practical things can people do to get that sense? So many of us live in a world where the things we face are mostly screens, and they're constantly trying to get our money or our vote or our likes. It's an endless solicitation. You can't eliminate it entirely, obviously, but get involved in growing and making things. It doesn't need to be a big production. I'm not going to recommend that everyone start a garden. Grow one plant, cultivate a flower or fern, and then come into the presence of it. See its growth. Sense the aliveness of the world. Another thing people can do is get involved in making things, knitting sweaters, building furniture. Those little acts of creativity put you in deeper touch with the physical world, and you begin to sense how the physical world is a place that is suited for our flourishing. It's a confirmation of the goodness of the world, the sense that the natural world is packed with beauty, delicious flavors and beautiful colors and fragrant aromas. What's going to precipitate all of this happening is leaders in our community making the subject a subject of conversation, a subject of analysis, because it's not too hard to get people to realize the capitalist drive of accumulation and consumption is not making us happy. It's not making us healthier. So we now need to figure out what are alternatives we can try on a smaller scale. But those smaller scales can build, and we can start to see models that can then be exported and expanded. We have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. I hope you'll listen again next time and that you've enjoyed it. I'm Mary Grace Payton, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.